Welcome to a special two-hour convention edition of All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. The Democratic National Convention starts today in Philadelphia, and while the goal was unity and a positive message, a leak of emails via WikiLeaks shows that the DNC and chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz were actively trying to undermine the Sanders campaign. Sanders supporters are rallying outside of the convention hall today with their Bernie or bust message. And for the first time since May, Donald Trump has overtaken Hillary Clinton in an average of head-to-head national polls in the presidential race, albeit by a very slim margin. Joining us now is Craig Gilbert. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief and writes the Wisconsin Voters blog about politics and elections. Craig, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
You're in Philadelphia now, of course, and we'll discuss the Democratic National Convention here in a second. But let's first take a minute to reflect on what happened last week in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Wisconsin played a pretty big role, didn't it?
Yeah, we have the head of the party, Reince Priebus. We have the Speaker of the House, who is also one of the presiding officers of the convention, Paul Ryan. We have a former presidential candidate who lost to Donald Trump in the race, Scott Walker. And then you had a lot of other people from Wisconsin that were very involved in actually putting on the convention. You had a number of speakers from Wisconsin. What's interesting to me about the role Wisconsin played is that Wisconsin has a very strong Republican Party. A lot of these people, as party regulars, were not with Donald Trump. And they've only come around to him late in the game, and they've really gone from being anti-Trump to being anti-Trump. I mean, they helped put down the Stop Trump movement in the name of party unity, which is, you know, full of irony.
And it's true that Wisconsin was the state that handed Donald Trump his last and arguably worst loss of the primary season. Given how Scott Walker and other Wisconsin conservatives were in their opposition to Donald Trump, how awkward was it that they were speaking at the convention for them or for Trump?
You know, it's been awkward for a long time for everybody. He's a nominee that has made this as painful a process as possible for a lot of Republicans, either because they disagree with him on issues, or because they don't like his rhetoric and his style, or because they're afraid of they question his ability to win in November. So, but what you are seeing is over time, what happens is, you know, voters come home, parties coalesce. The one thing that does unite Republicans is their animus toward Hillary Clinton. And to whatever degree they, particularly with these polls coming in, they sense an opportunity to actually win the election, I think they'll coalesce even further. It's awkward because for people like Scott Walker, you know, there's a whole kind of war of words there and a history there. And they've had to swallow all the things that Donald Trump has said about them. In the case of Ted Cruz, he couldn't. The things he said about Ted Cruz's family, That's part of what makes it painful. It's also painful because Donald Trump represents a different kind of different direction for the Republican Party than the one they would choose.
And some of those Republican people from Wisconsin might have ideological concerns related to Donald Trump. There are also some of them who have election concerns with Donald Trump because they have to decide whether they're going to align with him or not. It was pretty clear that Governor Walker was leveraging the convention to reanimate his national profile. He did some breakfast speeches with delegates from South Carolina and Iowa. Do you see this as an indication that he's already looking at 2020 or maybe beyond?
Well, you know, I think it's a long time away. I think you want to keep yourself in the conversation. You don't want to close off any options. I mean, he did say, and he has been saying, that if he runs for re-election in 2018 as governor, he would not run for president in 2020. Now, of course, there could be a Republican president anyway, but he said that one of his takeaways from what his recent experience was that you can't do both. You can't be a good governor and be a good presidential candidate. And he blames his sagging poll numbers, even though it's been, I think, 10 months since he got out of the race. He still blames his kind of weak approval ratings in Wisconsin on the fact that he did try to do that, that he did try to run nationally while he was governing the state. So, you know, it's going to take a while for all this to settle. I mean, one thing, you know, I think that does have to happen is if he does want to run again nationally, he does have to improve his standing in his home state. And certainly he has to do that if he wants to run for re-election as governor.
We should also talk about Ron Johnson's speech. Would it be fair to call it an attack ad against Russ Feingold? It seemed like it was more about his election than that of Donald Trump's.
Yeah, it was. And that was a little bit unusual about his speech. He was kind of a last-minute addition to the program. Reince Priebus from Wisconsin asked him to speak a little bit on national security. It wasn't clear he was going to come to the convention. You know, it's, again, he's one of those people who's been in an awkward place because he's, Trump was obviously not his first choice. He has clear differences with Trump. I think he's got some legitimate concerns about Trump's impact on the ballot in November and how that might affect him. For all these Senate candidates, you know, if Trump doesn't perform well at the top of the ticket, they're going to have, they have to run that many points ahead of their presidential nominee to have a chance of winning their own election. And that's not easy to do in a day and age when there's less and less ticket splitting. So the polling hasn't been encouraging for Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. It hasn't been encouraging for Donald Trump in Wisconsin, but it's a fluid environment. And we've seen, you know, Donald Trump get a bounce so far out of the first few post-convention polls that have been done, and now we've got the Democratic convention.
Very shortly after the GOP convention, it was announced that Republican funders, specifically the Koch family, were pulling out $2 million in TV ad buys that were going to go for Johnson. Was that a repercussion for supporting Trump for speaking at the convention?
No, I think it was more people are making calculations, hard, cold political calculations about where their money is best spent. Those calculations may change over the course of the rest of the summer and fall. At any point in time, these groups are, you know, figuring out, you know, which races are the most winnable and which aren't. And so their priorities are shifting. And if they see a race where they think the chances of Republicans winning are not as good as they are in other states, then you're going to see that money move around. So there's been some money leaving the Senate race in Wisconsin. But again, that could change in a couple. It could change if the presidential race tightens in Wisconsin. It could change if the Senate race tightens. It's discouraging, though, when your side is behind in every poll. So I think Ron Johnson and Republicans need to see some polling that has the race not just within the margin of error, but, you know, where they're either tied or ahead in some of these surveys.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert. He's the Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. We're doing an extended two-hour edition of All Things Political today, talking about the start of the Democratic Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Craig, just today, there showing that some of the averages of national polls are showing Donald Trump ahead of Hillary Clinton for the first time since May. It's a small margin, but it is the first time that he has taken the lead. Looking here at Wisconsin, what's the latest on who is leading in a head-to-head between Clinton and Trump here in our state?
Well, we don't have any post-convention polls, and, you know, we'll see some polling after both conventions. You kind of have to wait for the dust to settle. It's very fluid right now. The last Wisconsin poll that was done was before the Republican convention, and Hillary Clinton was leading by, I think, 4 or 5 among likely voters, 6 or 7 among registered voters. She's consistently been ahead, but in recent polling, it's been single digits as opposed to double digits. And, you know, she does have the advantage. I mean, she's been leading in this state that's voted Democratic 7 times in a row, but as weak as Donald Trump's numbers are in Wisconsin, her numbers are not that much better. So she's got some vulnerabilities, and I think that gives Republicans some hope because she's not nearly as popular, for example, as Barack Obama is in Wisconsin among a whole range of voting groups.
Well, and Craig, is this unique that you almost have to look more closely at the unfavorable ratings of both candidates instead of the favorable ratings? Because it seems like there are a lot of people this cycle who are voting more against one candidate than really for another.
Yeah, I mean, when you have, first of all, when your negatives are higher than your positives, and when you have negatives as high as both of these candidates do, and when they're both, and when you're very well known, so it's not because there's lots of undecided. That's a strange environment. It's not really like anything we've seen, and it does kind of feel like a race to the bottom in terms of whose weaknesses are weaker. And so they both have high negatives, particularly among independents. I mean, in some of the polling that Marquette Law School has done among independents, I mean, neither candidate is really above 30% among independents. So you've got, you know, Clinton and Trump both at 30%, that leaves 40% of the electorate that doesn't want to support either of these major party candidates. So they're divided between maybe voting for a third party candidate, you know, supporting neither, don't know, maybe not going to vote. Some of those people will come around to either Trump or Clinton, but that's still a kind of a stunning set of numbers at this stage of the race.
Let's go to the phones, and Willem in Colfax is up first. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I watched as much of the Republican convention as I could take, excuse me, because I found it extremely negative and childish, I would think. The whole Chris Christie thing I thought was, you know, beyond the pale of any political posturing I'd seen. And I think Scott Walker's numbers, the reason they're down, at least to the people I talk to around where I live, is not because of that he ran for president, is that he lied about it. He said, you know, a week before the election that it wasn't on his radar, and 2 days after the election he was running to be president. And I find this consistent with Scott Walker. He's a politician, a career politician, who's spent his whole life in on the public sector. Everything he has, he owes to the taxpayers of Wisconsin. And I think that for him to support someone like Donald Trump, and I include Ron Johnson in this, who's supposedly a security expert, how can they support someone who wants to dismantle NATO, something that's created peace in Europe since the end of World War II, something that hasn't happened in Europe in 1,000 years? And, you know, Putin, he likes Donald Trump because if NATO disappears, then he can pick off the Baltic states or whatever he wants one by one. And
all right, Willem, I'm going to leave it there so Craig has a chance to respond. So I think Willem is saying partly that Scott Walker and Ron Johnson are actually involved in the work of governance and making policy and running a country and a state. How does Donald Trump fit into that for them?
Well, and you could ask the same question about Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, who hesitated to endorse Trump and clearly endorsed him with some reluctance, and has not hesitated before and since then to criticize Trump when he disagrees with his policies or his rhetoric. So this is where we're at. I mean, this is a Republican Party both parties obviously have divisions, as we're seeing here in Philadelphia as well. But it's a Republican Party that has a populist base right now that's, there's a disconnect with the kind of some of the establishment and the leadership of the party on issues ranging from trade to immigration to entitlements to national security. And that's been it's fascinating to watch. It's not pretty. It's something that the party's going to have to wrestle with. But parties do, parties are kind of like tribes in a way, and people tend to come home within both parties over the course of the election. And that's partly because of what we talked about earlier, which is that as much as anything they're voting for, they're voting against the other side. And, you know, the unanimity of Democrats in their opposition to Donald Trump and the unanimity of Republicans in their opposition to Hillary Clinton is just staggering to behold.
Before we let you go, Craig, we started out talking about how prominent Wisconsin was in the GOP convention. Many of the speakers, many members of the GOP leadership. Is Wisconsin going to play as big a role this week at the DNC?
No, in a word. I mean, you don't have the equivalent. You don't have a DNC chair from Wisconsin. You don't have a House Speaker from Wisconsin. You don't have a former presidential candidate from Wisconsin. So that's, you know, it was kind of a remarkable set of circumstances on the Republican side. This is a more normal set of circumstances on the Democratic side. Wisconsin, though, is still a state that matters to Democrats because it's a state they've been counting on as part of their electoral coalition every 4 years. It's a state they've won in every presidential election since 1984. It's a state they really can't afford to lose, and it's a state that in theory is where Donald Trump is trying to expand the map in these sort of more white, blue-collar Midwestern battlegrounds. And so that, in that sense, it matters. It remains to be seen how competitive it's going to be and whether it's truly absolutely in play, but it's in the mix, and it's a state to keep an eye on.
Craig, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Great to be with you.
Craig Gilbert is the Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. Well, we are going to pick up in just a moment with Joan Walsh, the nation's national affairs correspondent and an MSNBC political analyst, and Francesca Chambers, who is White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. She's been covering the Democratic race. And more of our special All Things Political DNC convention coverage is coming up in just a moment. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to the Ideas Network. As we did last week for the GOP convention, we are taking a look at the Democratic National Convention on an extended edition of All Things Political. Joining us now from the Democratic National Convention, which is kicking off today in Philadelphia, is Joan Walsh. She's the nation's national affairs correspondent and an MSNBC political analyst, as well as a Wisconsinite. Joan, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we also hope to have Francesca Chambers on with us shortly. And callers, please hold on. We will definitely get to you as soon as we're able. So, Joan, many have described the Republican National Convention mood as doom and gloom, kind of a Gotham City before Batman feel. What are you experiencing at the Democratic National Convention right now?
Well, I think, you know, you can see some of it on television from a distance. There is a lot of turmoil over the leak of these Democratic National Committee emails that show, you know, they don't show what some of the Sanders supporters say. They don't really show a rigged process, but they certainly show a lot of folks within the DNC, including former chair, ousted chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, expressing a level of anger and irritation with the Sanders folks, and certainly looking for ways to bolster the Clinton campaign, at least in the media. So, you know, it definitely does. I think a lot of people are exaggerating what it shows, but it certainly leaves a bad feeling even for people like me who, you know, have supported Secretary Clinton. There's something kind of unseemly about it. And so it's a shame that, you know, I think the convention night speakers are going to be great and there will be so much more party unity. We will not have a Ted Cruz moment from Senator Bernie Sanders, that's for sure. But for now, there's a lot of convention intrigue and drama. These things, I have to say, though, that you always find, you think about what's going to show up on television, and that's usually the lasting legacy of conventions. But when you're there and you're at them, every twist and turn and all the process stuff looks very dramatic. So it may be that that's sort of, that it's all overblown and that, you know, people will look back on this week as one of, in fact, unity. But for now, there's a lot of attention to the process drama.
Well, this just earlier this hour, when we heard the news from NPR, they had a clip of Senator Sanders saying to his supporters how it's critical to elect Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine as the next president and vice president, and he was booed. So do you really think there's going to be unity coming out of that kind of staunch support, even when the Bernie supporters are hearing it from Bernie Sanders himself?
Well, you know, I thought that was very interesting. I mean, Senator Sanders did what he could to make a call for Hillary Clinton. Now, a lot of those people in the room are not actual delegates, so they won't necessarily be in the convention hall either tonight or any of these four nights. But I think there is some reason for the Clinton folks to be concerned. I do have to say, though, I mean, it'll make a nice show for the television cameras, but polls are out today showing that 90% of people who supported Sanders in the primaries will support Hillary Clinton. So there's a very vocal group of people that are getting a lot of attention, but, you know, their voice is outsized compared to their real numbers in the electorate.
And we are happy to have Francesca Chambers joining us now as well. She is the White House correspondent for DailyMail.com, also covering the 2016 presidential race. And she was embedded with both the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders campaigns during the primary season. She, too, is at the convention now. Francesca, so glad you could join us.
Yes, Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So we were just talking a little bit about the general tone at the Democratic convention, that there was a hope that it would seem much more positive and unified and we're all in this together than the GOP convention was. Of course, a lot of news over the weekend makes that a little more difficult. What is your sense of the pulse of the convention?
Well, I think that Bernie Sanders has a real opportunity, as well as Elizabeth Warren, to go into this convention tonight and do what you were saying, which is bring the party together. That is the wing of the party that's really resisting Hillary Clinton still as the Democratic nominee. So they have a lot of weight on their shoulders going into tonight to try and convince the people who are supporting them, who supported Bernie Sanders in the election, but also would have wanted Elizabeth Warren to run or to be vice president, to convince them that they should vote for Hillary Clinton.
And now, speaking of the potential running mate, having been talked about Elizabeth Warren and others, Hillary Clinton announced her vice presidential pick late last week, U.S. Senator from Virginia, Tim Kaine. And, you know, one of the questions is, will Tim Kaine appease or appeal to the left wing of the party, those Sanders supporters? Joan, why don't we start with you?
Well, so far, I think, he hasn't been able to make his case to a lot of the Sanders supporters. Again, I haven't seen any polling on it, and it's probable that, just like I said, with the polls versus Sanders people in Philadelphia, okay, the polls may show that people are fine with it, but the very vocal Sanders supporters who are here are talking about trying to mount a floor fight against Tim Kaine and to put somebody else's name in nomination. I personally think that would be really unfortunate if something like that happened. I think that Tim Kaine does not get the credit that he deserves. A friend of mine, Crystal Ball, who's from Virginia, wrote the progressive case for Tim Kaine in the Huffington Post. And as somebody who watched him in the context of Virginia, she considers him very progressive. He's been an incredible fighter for civil rights and against housing discrimination. As a young lawyer, he was elected mayor of Richmond, Virginia, a majority African-American city, with the city council votes of his black colleagues. He's been a fighter in a context. Virginia was part of the South, so much so that after the Voting Rights Act was passed, the city actually annexed a nearby suburb to dilute black voting strength. So, his courage in Richmond, Virginia shows he's a person of courage and not a kind of, lazy blue dog Democrat. He's also taken on the NRA, which is based in his home state of Virginia. On some business issues, he's been more centrist. And I think there are causes for concern. I wouldn't whitewash them, but I think that he's being given awfully short shrift by some of the very vocal lefty delegates here. In the context of Virginia, it's taken a lot of courage for him to take the stance he's taken. I think I expect to hear a case for why he deserves progressive votes made much more lustily on Wednesday night when he speaks.
And Francesca, what would you add to that Tim Kaine biography sketch that Joan just gave us?
Well, I did have an opportunity to see Tim Kaine speak with Hillary Clinton in Miami at the rally on Saturday. And I think that, as Joan was saying, that once delegates have a chance to actually hear from them, they might find out some things that they didn't know about him before now. I learned a lot just listening to him from that speech in Miami. And I think that people do forget about the Virginia Tech shooting, which is a really strong part of his personal story as a Virginia elected official. When he talks about how he was in Japan on a trade mission and had just landed and then found out about the shooting. He got back on a plane and came back. He said it was 14 hours there, 14 hours back. He came right back to his state and just how heartbreaking it was. And it was the worst day of his life when all those college students were shot on campus. And he was saying that one of the professors who also died, he had made it out of Germany, made it through the Holocaust, and then ended up dying in the shooting in America, and how tragic that was. When he talks about those sorts of things, he was very very strong. And I think that's something that progressives will be able to latch on to as well as his fight against the NRA.
One of the things that he also highlighted in that speech in Miami with Hillary Clinton on Saturday was that he had lived in Honduras for a year, took a year off of Harvard Law School to go work with missionaries. And he spoke very strongly about how faith, family, and work are his guiding principles. And faith, being a Catholic, having been raised in a Jesuit school community and by a very Catholic family, that faith is very important to him. Is that a plus or a minus for him on the Hillary Clinton ticket? Joan?
You know, I think he's going to be a real plus. You know, I think we saw, as Francesca said, in Miami, that he's a better campaigner than people give him credit for. He's not a boring guy, no matter what, you know, no matter what his opponents say. And, you know, I think the base of the African-American and Latino base of the party is going to be really happy with Tim Kaine. I think that a lot of white progressives are going to have a harder, may have a harder time warming up to him. But I think that we've got a real dramatic scene in Philadelphia this week, or at least today. That's going to get a lot of attention. But as the campaign goes on, I think that both Clinton and Kaine are going to be solid, make a solid case for why they're such a black and white alternative to Trump Pence.
We're talking right now with Joan Walsh of The Nation and also with Francesca Chambers of DailyMail.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will you be watching the Democratic Convention this week? What are you hoping to see come out of it? Who are you planning to vote for when November rolls around? That's 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones and Philip in Elkhorn. Hi, Philip.
Hey, how's it going? Listen, I've actually changed my question. You know, I was a very early supporter of Bernie Sanders. In fact, when he announced, I sent him money like 24 hours afterwards. But I've been watching politics for a long time, and this is the first time that I'm really quite frightened of one of the candidates. And I really think that Bernie Sanders supporters, as well as Bernie, need to really wake up to the fact that this is a really significant choice, not only for the country, but for the world. And you know, this need for purity and the liberal, all that stuff. I'm just about as liberal as they come, but this is too important for that nonsense. And he better step forward and tell his people that, and they better get in line because it's too important for this diddling around. I mean, I really have had some difficulty in discussions with some of my own friends on this, but that's the way I feel about it. I mean, there's no question about who I'm going to vote for. And Kaine, I mean, he's a great choice, you know? And if he's not liberal enough, I mean, seriously. So that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Philip. And Francesca?
Well, Bernie Sanders has been very outspoken about his support for Hillary Clinton and making clear that there's two choices in this election. You have the Republicans or you have Hillary Clinton, the Democrat. And if his supporters, you know, don't vote at all, then Donald Trump could be the next president of the United States. And he has said over and over again that Donald Trump must not be the next president of the United States. And so we'll see him saying it again tonight. He also was telling delegates today already, you know, you have to get behind Hillary, and explaining to them in his view why. So I think Bernie Sanders has been saying that clearly. But again, we'll have an opportunity to hear from him again tonight and listen to him make that case on national television.
Let's go back to the phones, and Kevin in Ashland joins us. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
My thought was there was a statement made that 90% in the polls, 90% of Bernie's supporters were in support of voting for Hillary. And there was a very vocal 10% that's opposed to that. My concern and what the perspective is that the platform, when it was put together, are Bernie's ideas as far as student tuition relief, climate change, and action on climate change, and Citizens United, whether those things are really going to be adequately supported by Hillary, and is the presumption that the 90% is just giving up on that platform.
Thanks for that call, Kevin. And Joan, do you want to talk about what parts of Bernie Sanders' platform or positions have been adopted and which have not?
Oh, I think, you know, Senator Sanders got about 90%. Speaking of 90%, I think he got about 90% of what he wanted. You know, he got the $15 minimum wage, you know, that number specified in the platform, higher than Clinton wanted. He got a death penalty moratorium abolition. He got a financial transaction tax. He got tuition-free public college, which is essentially what he wanted. I don't think he ever was calling for private universities to also be free. The language, he got a restoration of Glass-Steagall banking regulations in the platform. And, you know, yesterday he got the number of superdelegates cut by two-thirds. So, you know, to the caller, if you watched Senator Sanders' speech this afternoon, he laid out how much of what he got, and including language on Citizens United. He did not get a fracking ban, that is true, and he did not get a specific you know, prohibition against voting for the TPP in the platform because President Obama lobbied strongly against it, and there were people in the party who did not want to embarrass the president on what is one of his few remaining issues that he's not getting from Democrats, because the Democrats opposition, not merely Republican opposition. Mm-hmm. So I think Senator Sanders is very happy with what he got. Jeff Weaver, his campaign manager, thanked Clinton yesterday for his gracious leadership, he said. And for those of us who watched the way, you know, Jeff Weaver scalded the Clinton campaign all season long, that was a big step. So I think that the both Senator Sanders, his campaign, and his top surrogates are very happy with the way the process has gone. Now it's going to take some time, I think, for them to make that case to their strongest supporters, some of whom have been outside the party and some of whom, you know, really despise the Democratic Party. There will be, you know, I'm sure there will be 10% of his voters who never come around, because, you know, more than that number probably always sit out these elections or vote for the Green Party and really, you know, believe that the Democratic Party is hopelessly corrupt. That's not going to change. Mm-hmm.
Francesca, there are some concerns that, people have voiced about Tim Kaine. There's a question about his stance on abortion, being a Catholic himself. Is that something that you heard him address on Saturday?
Well, I think one thing that Hillary Clinton did that was very good was actually preempted any questions about that. And as soon as she named him, she lined up the pro-choice group that might otherwise have been upset and got them all on board, releasing statements saying that he's been a good advocate for women. And I think it also goes back to the argument that Donald Trump has said these things that are offensive or demeaning about women in the past. And so the Clinton campaign is relying on that and saying, you know, look, he is going to be a better vice president for women. Our ticket is going to be better for women than Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Mike Pence, particularly in Indiana, you know, supporting legislation that would make it more difficult for women to get abortions, and not supporting Planned Parenthood. And so, over, you know, they're trying to make the argument, like, overall, if you look at these two tickets side by side, this is going to be the ticket that is going to be better for women and better for women's health choices.
I believe that in that speech in Miami, Tim Kaine did say that he is personally against abortion, but that he feels that that is not something that should be legislated for women, that they should make their own choices. And I believe that it's been publicized that besides that F rating from the NRA, he has gotten an A rating from Planned Parenthood.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that the Clinton people did a great job kind of, you know, rolling this out and getting, you know, getting people. I was on the Rachel Maddow show on Friday night, and right before me, Cecile Richards from Planned Parenthood was there, and she spoke eloquently about why Tim Kaine, you know, is her choice, why he has a 100% voting record from Planned Parenthood and NARAL, the other big abortion rights groups. And, you know, I speak as a pro-choice Catholic myself. You know, Tim Kaine has, by his own admission, evolved on this issue. He did go into public life very progressive on civil rights, but not so progressive on the issue of choice. As a Catholic, as a devout Catholic, Jesuit-educated Catholic, you know, I have a lot of people like that in my family. But over time, I think what he says that I think is the most we can hope for, really, from people who are genuine Catholics, is to say, I may be personally against it, but in the public realm, it's got to be a woman's choice. That is 100% pro-choice. I know that there are people, friends of mine even, who are working right now to kind of end the stigma around abortion and make abortion, you know, more of a women's health issue than something that is to be whispered about and people should be ashamed of. And they see Tim Kaine as a setback. But, you know, we've all got to live together. And I think what we want from government is that we each worship our own, or, you know, in our own way or not at all. Government has nothing to do with personal moral choices, and we form coalitions where we can. And so I think that's part of why the women's rights and abortion rights people have been so happy with Tim Kaine, because we've brought him along. Also, I think the left is too quick to read people out of their movement. You know, if you didn't start out on the right side of every issue and you've had to come along on issues, rather than saying, oh, great, we did a great job of persuading you, we like to say, no, you know, never. You're not genuinely pro-choice, pro-worker, you know, whatever the issue may be.
We're talking with Joan Walsh of The Nation and Francesca Chambers of The Daily Mail about the Democratic National Convention, which kicks off today in Philadelphia. It's part of an extended edition of All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We'll be back with them and your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we return to Joan Walsh and Francesca Chambers. And let's go back to the phones. And Joe in Pewaukee is up. Hi, Joe.
Oh, hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm kind of concerned that Donna Brazile may have some power in running the party during the convention. She was a Gore advisor, and just between you and me, he should have won easily in 2000. And I'm just kind of worried that, you know, if she's in a position to make decisions, I'm kind of worried.
All right, so just to kind of give a little background there, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has stepped down as head of the Democratic Party because of the leak of emails showing that the DNC had tried to sabotage the Sanders campaign to ensure a Hillary Clinton win. And so, Francesca, let's start with you. Who is going to take over the party, and what exactly does it mean to be the chair of a party?
Well, Donna Brazile, as he mentioned, will be taking over the Democratic Party through the election. And basically, at this point in the election, a lot of things are already underway. The Democrats already have, and the Republicans, a lot of staffers on the ground in these battleground states. So much of that is taken care of. And I was speaking with some high-level Democrats about this exact conversation last night. And some of the consensus was that the party chair's job is really to say the things in certain instances that the candidate either can't say or won't say, to make these attacks and be focused full time on making attacks on the opponent, to be on television, to be a high profile surrogate on television as well. I mean, that's a lot of the role that the party chair would take on. But it becomes very interesting because after the election, there will be a totally new Democratic Party chair. And by the way, regardless of what happened with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, that was going to most likely happen anyway. She's been Democratic Party chair for a long time as it is. But what they're looking for in a new chair, so many of them, establishment and progressive, the Democrats I was talking to, were saying that they would like to see someone that is seen as progressive lead the party, because it would help to bring along these Bernie Sanders supporters and other types in the Democratic Party who have felt kind of left out and marginalized in the past. And so one name that was going around was Keith Ellison, potentially, because he is in the Progressive Caucus. He also supported Bernie Sanders. At the same time, he's taken very seriously by the establishment. He's also in a leadership position in the Democratic Party in the House. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz did it as a member of Congress part-time, so there's nothing to say that someone like Keith Ellison couldn't do it part-time as well.
And Joan, how would you assess Debbie Wasserman Schultz's tenure as the chair of the Democratic Party? Let's leave aside what came out in the email leak, but before that, what kind of grade would you have given her?
I guess I would have given her a B. I don't think she was, you know, a terrific chair, but she, you know, the vilification she's getting now seems a little bit excessive too. But, you know, even during this primary, I have said many times, again, as a Clinton supporter, that she had a knack for making things with the Sanders camp worse than they needed to be, or worse, or she herself really should have stayed above the fray. She got into, you know, matches with, again, Jeff Weaver, the Sanders campaign manager, who's, you know, he was kind of volatile. He could be, you know, he could be very pointed and personal, but she let the criticism get to her. And, you know, I've spoken with Howard Dean, who likes her, but nonetheless said, you know, she did a little bit too much defending herself when she could have had other people defend her, and really should have stayed above the fray in a way that she just couldn't take the bait. When she was criticized, you know, she would go on TV and react very, very high-handedly, and, you know, in a manner that really antagonized the Sanders people and contributed to the notion that she was biased against them. And so these emails are getting attention because they seem to confirm a feeling that people had already. You know, I think that the party is doing the right thing. I think the idea, you know, I think she needed to step down. I think the idea that she would gavel the convention in tonight, you know, I'm sure this is all very humiliating for her, but it would have been way more humiliating and way more divisive if she had gotten up there and gotten booed. And I believe that she would have gotten severely booed if that had happened. So, you know, I think everyone is doing the right thing. To the caller's concern about Donna Brazile, I understand what you're saying, but, you know, I'm old enough to have covered 2000 as well, and I thought that Donna did an excellent job. The problem with the Gore campaign is that if you remember, you know, she shared campaign chair duties with Carter Eskew, who was from the real corporate centrist wing of the party, and she never had full control. And some people thought she was, you know, kind of window dressing to satisfy the party's liberal female African American base, but she didn't have the real power. So I'm happy to see Donna take this role. Finally, to Francesca's point, I'd love to see Keith Ellison do it. I haven't talked to him about whether he'd be interested, but he really is somebody that brings the two forces together. He was a terrific advocate for Senator Sanders without ever being, you know, nasty or unfair or personal about Secretary Clinton. Both sides like him. He played a real role in bringing together the two factions. He was on that convention platform committee I was talking about earlier, and really played a role in working with the Clinton folks in a very productive way to get the platform that you know, mostly he wanted. So I would love to see that.
Joe, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones and Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I contributed to Bernie's campaign in the beginning, and I'm really sorry to see that he's out. But the way I see it now, we're faced with Donald Trump, who is basically a super demagogue, and Hillary Clinton, who's banging the war drum with Iran and in bed with Netanyahu. So I'm really distraught at where we're at today. That, you know, and now the breaking news of the corruption with the DNC and what's all evolved around with Republican GOP. I'm really distraught over it.
So, Eric, where does that leave you?
Where? I don't know.
Bernie supporter?
I guess when I look at the rhetoric that Hillary has talked about with war with Iran and issues with Russia and over in the Baltic, I guess I don't know. I don't want to see a World War III, so I guess I don't know. I guess Trump would be the lesser of the two evils at the moment.
All right, Eric, let's leave it there. And I want to bring in Kenneth in Janesville next because he's having a similar issue. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. Moral leadership has always been an issue in presidential elections. I mean, with President Reagan, it was that he was divorced. Was an issue. I mean, is there anything that Hillary can do? I mean, Ken North has built a career of investigating her, and Congress has spent $16 million trying to charge her with something, but she just wants to be quiet about this issue, it seems. You know, how can Hillary become a moral leader?
Sure. And Kenneth, where would you put Donald Trump in that moral leader potential?
He's going to hell.
All right. So just to recap those two calls, Eric says that Clinton is too hawkish and that might push him towards Trump, even though he was a Sanders supporter. Kenneth Chu has issues with Clinton's political career, but he clearly has strong feelings about Trump as well. So, Francesca, let's start with you. Who is going to be able to attract these voters, or do they just stay out of the race?
Well, Donald Trump is trying very hard to try and get some of these disaffected Democrats who were Bernie Sanders supporters and telling them things like trade. You know, that is, as Joan was saying, one of the only things that Bernie Sanders did not get, but it was a very big part of his campaign, was this anti-Trans-Pacific partnership stance that he had against the president's trade deals. And Donald Trump has made a large part of his campaign saying, look, I'll make good trade deals for Americans. I'll renegotiate these deals. I'll bring back jobs. He's claiming that, you know, he'll bring back more jobs than anybody else in America. And so he's really trying to target them. At the same time, that is why Bernie Sanders has continually said, you know, if you were for me, don't vote for Donald Trump. You really can't believe what's coming out of his mouth. Like, you should vote for Hillary Clinton. She has come a long way on all of these issues. But I will say, interestingly, when it comes to trade, when Bernie Sanders got up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and endorsed Hillary Clinton, he did not talk about trade at all. He said nothing about it. She made a comment about trade during her speech, but he didn't talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership at all, which is, again, why now Donald Trump is now saying that even Bernie Sanders has sold out on this issue that was so pivotal.
And Joan, anything you would add? Is there a way for either side to capitalize on these voters who clearly are not happy with either choice?
You know, again, to anyone who thinks Donald Trump is less likely to get us into a war, I mean, we don't know what Donald Trump will do, honestly. He is so thin-skinned, narcissistic, motivated by vengeance to the point of, you know, now saying he's going to start a super PAC to defeat Ted Cruz in Texas. I think he would be a disaster on the world stage, even more so than he would on domestic policy. So, you know, I've always said Clinton is a little bit too hawkish for me. But, you know, she supported the Iran deal. She's the Secretary of State who helped negotiate the tough sanctions that got the world to collaborate and then led Iran to the bargaining table, where a great deal that averted war could be hammered out. So I think, you know, the notion of her hawkishness is somewhat overstated, although it's a concern that I share. But compared to Trump, there's absolutely no contest in terms of who is more likely to get us into a war.
And Joan, we have just a few more minutes left. You have covered a lot of conventions, a lot of campaigns. Is this year, are these conventions unlike anything you've ever seen?
Absolutely. I mean, the energy in the room in Cleveland was deeply disturbing. There were divisions there, but they were united in their hatred for Hillary Clinton, and so the cries of lock her up, it was like bloodlust. You could imagine that if she was there, something might have happened to her, you know, Secret Service or not. Cleveland, you know, the agenda is incredibly positive and exciting. You're going to have Michelle Obama tonight. You know, tonight you'll have people from Michelle Obama to Bernie Sanders who haven't always gotten along with Hillary Clinton. Michelle Obama was said to be much more angry than her husband was in 2008 about the Clintons' use of kind of racial, sometimes racially tinged arguments against him. And now she's going to be a character witness for her, as well as, you know, Bernie Sanders being a political witness. So I think, you know, the message that will go out to the country is going to be one of inclusiveness and unity. I don't know what's going to happen on the floor and, you know, whether there will be disruptions from some Sanders delegates, but they certainly won't be supported by Senator Sanders.
And Francesca, briefly, what are you expecting to see this week that might be different than the GOP convention?
Well, it's possible that the Bernie supporters, speaking of those disruptions, they could possibly, when Hillary Clinton is on stage, you could hear booing, you could hear them heckling her as well, which again goes back to why Bernie Sanders tonight has to convince them that they should support Hillary Clinton. We saw Donald Trump running rival in Cleveland, Ted Cruz, get up on stage and not endorse him. And that created a lot of disruption within the convention and continuing on now, as Joan was also noting. So one thing that you'll see that's very different is you will see Bernie Sanders, who was the rival for Hillary Clinton, get up there and endorse her again, say that delegates should vote for her, and there will be unity in that sense, but not necessarily, his delegates may not necessarily feel the same exact way, and we'll find out.
Well, thanks to you both for joining us. Joan Walsh, the nation's national affairs correspondent and an MSNBC political analyst. It was great to have you with us, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
And Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for the Daily Mail, who's been covering the Democratic race. Francesca, always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you'll stay tuned, because after the news, we're going to continue our extended All Things Political with another great panel of experts to discuss this week's Democratic National Convention. Tomorrow at this time, Kathleen speaks to Peggy Orenstein about how direct conversations about sex are becoming increasingly rare between teenage girls and adults. Her guest says that this has unfortunately led many girls and young women to turn to pornography for sex education as they try to navigate tricky cultural norms that tell them they're sluts on the one hand and prudes on the other. That's tomorrow's show at this time. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Cheryl Gasser and Dave Potraz for on-air production. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Political right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.